Welcome to The Deep End by On Deck, a podcast for visionary builders, creators, and thinkers discuss world-changing stories and ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozloff. Let's dive in.
One of the more shocking things to our business that I've learned is it was very hard to convince a lot of the players to join our platform in the beginning, even though we are free. So we don't take commissions off people playing. We're the Robinhood approach. We don't have fees. We'll make money later on some other future business models we have planned. But we put out a free platform. We offer the same exact game as a competitor. And basically, like, we were struggling to acquire users in the very beginning. Now the company is doing quite well, which goes back to putting your head down, grow community with a small population of people, do the right things. They start to tell their friends, and that other platform starts to pivot users to you.
On Deck is where ambitious people worldwide go to start companies, find their next roles, and invest in their careers. The Deep End invites the founders, operators, and investors from the On Deck community and beyond to turn their experiences into the ideas others need to start their own odysseys. Joining me this week in The Deep End is Anthony Geranio, founder and CEO of 1V1Me, and an alum of the On Deck Founders Fellowship. 1V1Me is an app to play video games for money. We haven't had a pure esports episode yet, so it was great to chat with Anthony about the rise of video games, especially as it coincided with the regulation of sports betting. Anthony credits these changing macro conditions, as well as COVID shutting down sports leagues for a while, for how companies like his have been able to quickly come on the scene and add a social element to video games. Our discussion also touches on the toxicity of video game culture, the advantages of bringing influencers onto the cap table, building content machines, and much, much more. For more on 1v1me, you can check out 1v1me.com or follow Anthony on Twitter at Anthony Geranio. All right, here's the episode. Let's dive in. Anthony Geranio, welcome to The Deep End.
Thanks for having me.
We mostly do this podcast for audio, but for those who watch on YouTube, you will notice that Anthony has a really cool backdrop. There's lots of good Supreme gear. He's got some decks on the wall. Something that I've been noticing more and more when I talk to founders is founders are cool. Now, I'm not kidding, in a way that if we were doing this in 2012, we would have a lame hoodie, you look kind of grungy. What's happening for people in our cohort?
Yeah, I think it's trickier for me because I've always grown up like collecting sneakers and different things. Like I've always had like different trinkets and items. So Supreme, I've been a fan of since I was a kid. I was really big into skateboarding. That's where that culture comes from. So I think now more than ever, though, people are realizing that they have to kind of express themselves, and they look at what rappers and different people are wearing around them, and they want to be cool and they want to try to at least act cool. I sort of see that with like NFTs and different items like that. Just kind of like if you think about putting on a headset and walking into someone's house in the metaverse, you sort of can identify their version of a Supreme deck or a Gucci bag by like what they have and how exclusive it is. So I kind of grew up around exclusivity. I was the kid waiting online in front of Foot Locker for Jordans. I was also selling them. So we set up this backdrop in my basement just, you know, as another form of expression. I hop on a ton of video calls as a founder, and I want people to know like I'm more than just like a nerd or someone that just like, you know, is trying to start a company. Like I love fashion. I used to work for one of the biggest secondhand luxury fashion marketplaces. And this is just like me. Like I have a Cowboys thing. I have a ton of Yankee stuff. So yeah.
Okay. That's the perfect place to start then. Okay. So you know this then, right? Like actually participating, sneaker community, like all that different stuff. I feel like a lot of people in the NFT Web3 space are trying to force exclusivity, coolness, vibes, whatever, from actually lived in the like in real life version of these communities. What's your main takeaway there? Like what's working, what isn't working?
So I will preface this by saying I do not own one NFT. I do have crypto, but I don't own one NFT. And I've seen a lot of fashion brands try to paint exclusivity themselves. You know, Grailed is a place I used to work. There's a ton of like, you know, mom and pop, let's just say, like people create Instagram accounts, try to sell clothing on the website, whatever, to try to grow their brand. I don't think you can really create like that sort of scarcity in like a forced way. I think you have to create culture and community, and that sort of just has to grow themselves, similar to what we're building, right? It's not going to happen overnight. So, you know, you can create artificial demand by, you know, only making five of this thing or six of that thing. But if the right people don't buy it and it doesn't feel organic, I don't think it really has long longevity. So we'll see what happens with, you know, most of them. But I think for the most part, it's really just about how do the right people get in the seats for the right organic reasons, not just like paying them a bag of cash, because the harsh reality of the situation is they're just going to go somewhere else for a bag of cash and do the same thing, and their fans are going to recognize it. And the value is going to drop, whether that means a stock price or you walk into someone's house in the metaverse and you see something that, you know, got shilled. I don't know. But I think for now, it's just, you know, a lot of these brands have, like Supreme, for instance, has been around for a very long time. So I think it's like, put your head down, hopefully get the right people involved, and just run towards a vision. And then eventually you could do things like toolboxes and, you know, cups and different things, and people won't care as long as it has the logo on it.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, let's just hit the top. You referenced what you're building. Just what are you building?
So I work on a company called 1v1me. 1v1me is an app where you can play someone else in a video game for money. So think about playing someone in Call of Duty for $10. Whoever wins gets paid.
What in, I know this is such a boring question, but I think there's an interesting answer here. What inspired you to get into that space specifically? It's the TechCrunch article about your company leads with, you know, Anthony was playing video games for 13 years, which is a funny opener because, like, I think most people have played video games for that period of time. Yep. So, like, what's your origin story in this context?
Yeah, so I didn't really grow up with, you know, many friends in like middle school and high school. You know, I sort of like to be the kid in my room and sort of like playing games and different things. A lot of my friends were online. So I was just very addicted to video games from a very young age. You know, I did two things. I played baseball and played video games. And you see that with a lot of athletes today. Like, it's no secret. Like, Grayson Allen is a huge Apex player. He's also on the Bucks in the NBA in the starting lineup. So I think just like, you know, I played one sport, and then the only other thing I played was video games. And baseball only happens one season out of the year unless you're doing it a little bit more aggressively. Like, I played in the fall and the spring and whatever. So I think that for me, it was just like, that was the thing I enjoyed doing. And, you know, I made YouTube videos. I played competitively. I went to LAN tournaments back when the culture was just sort of beginning, I guess, when the first couple tournaments were happening at GameStops and stuff. So I just grew up playing games, and I even found like a thing I wrote in like fourth or fifth grade at my parents' house last week that said like the three things I do is like eating, sleeping, and playing PS2. So like, it was just something I was obsessed with. And then what basically happened was, growing up in New York and New Jersey, there's a huge culture around sports betting and, you know, sports in general. A lot of my friends like to bet on sports. They like to watch sports. You know, you have the Yankees, the Giants, the Jets, huge culture around those teams around our area. So during COVID, basically sports was shut down. Stadiums were locked away. You know, you couldn't go to see a game live. And my friends had really nothing to do and nothing to bet on. So we started to play video games like Madden, FIFA, Call of Duty. And then we started to play for money because, you know, my friends and I don't just want to play for like fun. Like, we like to take each other's money and sort of like be able to, you know, banter back and forth about it. So we started to do that. And that sort of brought me back in time to when I used to play competitively. I used to play on this website called Game Battles, which still exists today. You had a team, you had a reputation, whatever. And it meant the world to be like the top team. And I always just thought like, hey, why hasn't this been done pretty aggressively since? Like, why hasn't the platform evolved? Why has the culture started shifting, especially when everyone's playing video games now? So I was already thinking about starting a company with my co-founder, Alex. Him and I had both worked at other companies together. And my job was sort of impacted from COVID. I was an engineer that turned into a product manager. They brought me back to being an engineer during COVID because they fired like 40 people. And I basically realized no one's going to have your back like yourself. You know, I was making like $200,000 a year at 25 years old. Like, that's a crazy amount of money for someone who didn't work for like Facebook or Google or Apple or whatever, right? So I think for me, it's like, you know, the harsh reality of like, you know, you can make a ton of money, And that's great. You know, it got me a lot of things in this life, and I'm especially grateful. But I will say that it didn't buy me happiness. Like, I only got into tech really because I was like someone who wanted to build and start something myself. So I think for me, it was just like a wake up call that now more than ever, this is the time to really start something. So I hit up Alex, and basically we just started working on 1v1me. I sent him a Facebook message that just said, "Hey, I have this idea for this platform," and he was game. And that's basically it.
It's interesting. You referenced just like the gambling culture around like New York, New Jersey. I'm from Oregon, so literal opposite of all of that. Can you talk about that part more?
Yeah, for sure. So like, you know, growing up, I think there's always an aspect of people who feel very strongly opinionated to say like, "Oh, you don't believe me? Put $5 on it or $10 on it." It was something we grew up saying. And even 1v1me itself, it's hilarious because the kids that I was playing video games with when I was like 14, 15 years old, they send me Instagram DMs like all the time saying like, "I still can't believe you started a company called 1v1me," because I was the kid in the Call of Duty lobby screaming like 1v1me.
You were that kid. You were the legendary. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, in like a more genuine and not like super, super toxic way. But I would say that I was the person that was like, "Oh, you're definitely not better than me," type thing. So and then I guess sports betting started really in college. You know, when you're in college, you're trying to make some money. A lot of your friends are just watching sports if you're not going out, because there's nothing else to do on like a Monday or Tuesday night, depending on the school you go to, until you're 21, of course. So, you know, a lot of me and my friends would put like bets in on NFL and NBA and whatever, and then you sort of just get addicted in hopefully a friendly way that doesn't hurt you. I've always been the type of person to really just like bet on one thing, like for football. Like, I don't like taking 15, 20 different bets. But there's people out there who like to really like put like $5 or $10 on everything. Like, my friend Ronnie loves playing $5 or $10 bets on like 8 different things, and sometimes he'll hit. So I think, you know, you just have different communities of friends, and my friends just happen to watch a lot of sports and bet.
I think something I'm curious about, given that your origin really focuses on just the video games industry and all of these spaces, whether it's gambling, Web3, NFTs, there's a lot of hostility between these different communities. Like, how are you thinking about that as a founder and just frankly a user, player, different stuff like that?
Yep. I think video games typically has like a pretty toxic community depending on the games you play, right? So like Call of Duty is pretty aggressive. Madden and FIFA is actually more friendly, but very, very hyper competitive. And I think like even Rocket League, as game as friendly as that, has a lot of toxicity to it. So, and I don't necessarily think that sports betting generally has a toxic community. I think it's very much a, "Damn, I can't believe you won $50,000 and I didn't," type thing. Or, "Hey, that bet might be fake. Like, I don't really believe that you won that amount of money." But I think the way we're thinking about it is 1v1me has a pretty decently honest community, which is great. So we have group chats in the app that people can talk in. And there's obviously people that come in and try to talk shit, but we're pretty aggressive about banning people for like being toxic or giving people warnings. We have like silence features and reporting features that we use pretty aggressively. We have a guy named John who goes in and basically like monitors all the chats. So I think for me, it's just more or less like keeping your platform as safe as you can and being really strict about the rules. If someone comes in and cheats or uses like the wrong wording, like, we ban them. And then the community starts to police itself. There's people that are starting to come to us and DM us and saying like, "Hey, look at this guy, he's doing this," or, "Hey, this person said this to me." So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the tattletale in school type of thing, in like a more innocent way, where like people are like, "Oh, you said that, you're going to get banned. You better not say that again," type thing. And I feel like you sort of want that in like an innocent way over time, because I think the community starts to churn on itself and like work with each other, and sort of starts to respect and know people in the community. So it's good we have those people, because I think it could be a different situation if everyone was just trying to be toxic 24/7. But I also think if we weren't strict in the beginning, it could really quickly spiral out of control.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason why I'm super pumped to talk with you is that you're just hitting all these different spaces, and something that you've referenced is interest in like really working with content creators. So like, there's the semi, like, there's obviously the faddish let's just talk about content creators thing, but like, given that you're in this like esports video gaming space, like this is actually huge, right? This is the Twitch stuff. This is all that. So just talk about your vision, like A, talk about how that's operating now, but also just your vision long-term for that.
Yep. So right now we work with content creators in several different ways. So we have like an affiliate program where we can basically bring them on and they could put like a 1v1me logo in their Twitch stream and then we pay them per sign up. It's very simple and maybe we'll give you some money on top depending on what your reputation is per month. And then we've worked with influencers a bit to do like sponsored YouTube campaigns, you know, like, hey, here's $500, do a 30 to 60 second shout out. And then more recently, we've started to invest in like athletes. So my friend's a UFC fighter. We sponsored him during his last fight. We were on like his shorts. So we do a couple different influencer things. What I think that we've started to do differently, which a lot of people are doing now or have been doing in the past couple of years, is actually getting content creators as investors in the company. So we have two of the largest Call of Duty YouTubers as investors in the company. In this next round of funding we're about to pursue, I'm going to get a slew of other content creators involved. So I think for me, it's like getting them invested, because going back to that bag of cash mentality, it's like I pay one content creator this amount, then another competing platform pays them a larger amount. They're just going to sort of like battle against each other. So we're starting to look for more genuine relationships that kind of matter more long term, people that are bought into the vision and the mission behind the company and sort of see that this thing has legs. I mean, if you look at it from a very like macro perspective, right? Sports betting market is massive. Like New York just did over $1 billion, I think, in their first month or something like that. So if you look at esports as like even a very bearish 5 or 10% of that market for what we're moving into, like the opportunity is endless. So we're not really looking for short term wins. I'd love to give content creators money. Like trying to do a living doing what you love. We're trying to do the same thing. But I think that we get more excited about opportunities where people want equity, can kind of come in and really like sink their teeth in and create videos for us pretty much organically, similar to how an employee joins your company and gets stock options. So I think for us, it's very similar.
Man, that's interesting, because I'd like to, you said vision, right? I asked you what the idea for the company is, like, what's the vision? Like, how do you differentiate those two things? Because like you said, you gave a great articulation that's very pitch deck worthy of the market, TAM, all those things. Like, there's a big opportunity. I'm sure a lot of places are going to want to jump into that. Like, what is 1v1me's unique vision of a simple but complicated space, I feel like?
Mm-hmm. I think fundamentally, it's like if you look at it, playing video games for money sounds super exciting. Anyone I've pitched on the idea is like, damn, I can't believe this doesn't exist yet, or wow, this is super cool. But I think the harsh reality of this situation is not everyone deserves to play a video game for money. Like, I don't think everyone deserves to put $10 on themselves in Call of Duty and play. You could try, but I think that you probably might lose depending on who else is on the platform. You can do some sort of skill-based matchmaking eventually. But I think the pool of people who really deserve to do this as a living is quite small today. Now, I think that'll rise, obviously, like if you look at video games and how many more people are playing now. Look at all the 14, 13-year-olds who are growing up on Fortnite. By the time they're 18, 19, are they still going to be playing video games, or are they going to be going to bars and clubs like we are? So I think if you just look at how people are going to grow up, I think that eventually the pool of very good players can get quite large. But right now we're sort of at this point where there's really only like maybe 30 Twitch streamers that really matter per game, depending on the community, that are getting like tons of viewers, that are hyper, really, really good. But there is a lot of players who are better than the streamers out there that play on our platform every day that we're really excited about. They have better stats. They're cracked at the game. Streamers are afraid to play them. It's the reality that they're really good gamers, but not great entertainers. Like, just because you're a Twitch streamer or a YouTube streamer or whatever doesn't mean that people want to watch you and aren't really like, you know, enticed by what you have to offer. I kind of look at it like the WWE. You're not just watching someone that they might be the best wrestlers because they're creating the most entertainment value out of them. They're like actors. Twitch streamers, most of them in Call of Duty, for instance, they're really good. Are they as good as someone that just plays in, you know, their basement 24 hours a day? I'm not quite sure, right? Like, the opportunities haven't been open for them to really battle against those people. A lot of these tournaments are invite only. So I think for us, we're trying to create a scene for amateurs to really thrive, you know, create like a amateur esports league sort of thing, or like our version of the UFC, where people come on our platform, compete, other people watch them play. And maybe there's some aspect of betting down the road that we get into on those players. But I think for us, it's just about creating this like amateur scene, super defensible, because, you know, we have the players and we've sort of helped them graduate, and then sort of allowing viewers to get involved on the action and sort of get entertainment value from it.
Dude, that is so cool, because several questions come up immediately. So one, so given what you're saying, WWE is the right metaphor here, because you have people on your platform who are better than the big streamers. And as people know, whether it's like YouTube, and I want to get into Twitch in a second, but I'm sure that there's a formula, or at least best practices for getting big on Twitch or doing well. Is there a world where you get into the talent business?
Maybe. It's something that my co-founder Alex and I have been talking about a bunch. Like, we discover talent and a lot of people that aren't signed to, you know, agents and whatever. And we've helped them grow. I've created opportunities for several different influencers on our platform, gotten them into tournaments, gotten them different deals with brands just through like people that I know and stuff. Like G Fuel is a popular one. It's like a energy drink. I've gotten like two or three affiliates on our platform, like G Fuel deals, just because I know someone at G Fuel. And then I'm like, hey, this person's content is really good. We've also created, like Taylor is someone that we discovered on like Twitter. He had a Call of Duty meme account. He joined our team, and then we had him start creating TikToks for us. That TikTok account has now over 250,000 followers or something like that in like 6 months of him doing it. He wasn't a content creator before it. He's never made like videos in that sort of way. So we sort of have gotten into the talent business. We also just got another content creator that has like 150,000 followers on TikTok. He's starting to make videos for us, and he just joined the team. So, you know, we're starting to create our own content, in terms of like a bar stool, like, hey, these are the top 10 plays on 1v1 me. This is like who won the last tournament. And those are sort of short form videos that we throw into the community. As far as us signing people and, you know, assigning people or having a team, that's all TBD. We like to think about scale. So like, how do you really scale a talent arm in an efficient way if you're always trying to battle against CAA, UTA, all these different people? And how do you do it efficiently? You know, like, yeah, you could sign, you know, two people. How do you grow that to 10, 100, 1,000? How do you like surface everyone? So, you know, there's decent money to be making. I know a lot of talent managers that are probably cranking $250,000 to $1 million plus a year in sports, esports, whatever. But is that venture backable? You know, like can you raise $10, $20, $30 million off that? And like, you know, is there a ton of money to be made in that business? I'm not quite sure. I think Ninja or one of the top streamers makes $25 or $30 million a year. Sick money, or like their contract. Insane money. I hope that one day I could even grow to that much. But how do you find like 15, 20 different ninjas and do that and turn that into like a $1 billion business? That's TBD, right?
Yeah, no. And you actually explained this well, where it's easy to say, like I just did in my question, oh, you've got the talent, and then you take the magic formula and you've got a million Twitch superstars. But that's not it at all. And actually, talent's an incredibly complicated and frankly, much less of a lucrative business than you would think it would be. Like you said, like at scale, there's a reason why CAA, I mean, UTA, it's complicated, but yeah, like totally, totally well taken there. So I guess the question then is, if you're not, so you're directional with the talent industry right now, but that's not your thing. How do you stay aligned with creators long term then? Because that's as with because this is the part, this isn't just an esports thing. This is just any platform where they're like, you're taking independent people and helping them make money. Yep. How do you think about, what's your philosophical approach to that?
So there are other platforms in our space that have existed in the past, and it has, one of the more shocking things to our business that I've learned is it was very hard to convince a lot of the players to join our platform in the beginning, even though we are free. So we don't take commissions off people playing. We're the Robin Hood approach. We don't have fees. We'll make money later on some other future business models we have planned, but we put out a free platform. We offered the same exact game as a competitor. And basically, like, we were struggling to acquire users in the very beginning. Now the company is doing quite well, which goes back to putting your head down, grow community with a small population of people, do the right things. They start to tell their friends, and that other platform starts to pivot users to you. So I think in the beginning, we underestimated, oh, we'll just be free and put out a couple YouTube videos and everyone will join. But I think it was very hard to convince people that, hey, like, I have to deposit money into this thing no one's used. Like, it's kind of sketchy, you know, even if you think about it, like, from an objective way, as like a founder or CEO, I want to think like our company's the best and everyone should use it. But we start to think about things objectively, like, would I really deposit money into a platform that has like 10 app store reviews that not many people are playing video? No shot. I haven't even bought an NFT, right? Because I'm skeptical. So think about like how much it would take for someone like me to join your platform. So I think once you have people in the platform that are really excited about what you're doing, you're policing the community the right way, you're doing right by, if a cheater comes into the platform, you ban them and do all the fundamentals that all the other companies in the space over a period of 3 or 4 years have messed up in countless times. And you go at it of the approach of, we need to be strict, we need to do things the right way, because these are the problems with the community that have them churn. It's going to be really hard to convince someone to join another platform, even if someone created like 2v2 me or something like that, because it's going to take them quite a while to probably build up the player base that we have and convince those people to join. At the end of the day, like, people want to join our platform because it helps them make more money and because it helps them grow their audience, because we have an integration where people can watch you. So once you incentivize the money aspect, they can make money on your platform and they could get matched quickly, and there's always someone to play against. That's like priority number one. And then priority number two is, oh, if they play on 1v1 me, do they start to get more viewers, fans, community engagement? Do people start to discover them more? That's also like another secondary need, that those problems are both very hard for like another company to spin up and solve. The matchmaking is a beast that comes with population, and then the viewership side also. So I think it's the incentives are already sort of aligned if you create the right marketplace dynamics for them. And because we're free, we're not taking any money away from them. So I think we're aligned on the monetization aspect too, of like, hey, we're not trying to be greedy. And this isn't about like taking money away from you.
The way you said the start of your answer suggested that streamers, gamers, whatever, have had trouble with platforms in the past. Like, is there a story there, or was I reading into things too much?
No, there's definitely like laundry list of stories, right? So I think the one is on the payment transaction side. I think that when you deal with people's money every day, I have sort of this thought in the back of my mind of, oh, what if our payment processor goes down, right? Like, you know, what if we have an outage? What if something happens? You know, it's something you don't leave, you lose sleep over as a founder in this business. You know, regulation plays somewhat of a way in our business. You know, it's not sports betting, it's classified under skill-based gaming, but at any time someone might carve out a different, like, law for it. So for instance, FanDuel and DraftKings used to be classified under skill-based gaming. Once they got so big, the government then decided, hey, we're going to carve out fantasy sports as a carve out in the law, which means like, hey, you can only do games of skill with fantasy in these states. So there is a world where someone might carve out something for 1v1me for like tournaments and wagering and esports. I actually think that that is 100% going to happen at some point, especially once you prove you can make hundreds of millions of dollars in this business. The government's going to want their money on taxes and different carve outs for that. So I think that a lot of platforms have struggled with their payment processor going down, or them not handling withdrawals properly, or deposits, or the way they really fund money. Because a lot of these businesses before 1v1me didn't really have many like investors. Like, a lot of them were operating as a side project, which would make profit. Game Battle sold to Activision. Like, Gamer Saloon is a really big one that was around since we were young. And I don't mind talking about those platforms, because I think it's very impressive that they've been around since like 2012 or whatever. So I think for us, it's like we're battling a different game anyway. So I think on the transaction side, people have lost like money or not gotten their money on time. That's table stakes when you deal with a platform with money. And then I think on like the cheating side in esports, there's been a lot of issues with cheaters and people that have different hacks or different modded controllers or whatever. And there's been people that haven't been banned from those platforms. You know, you can make 1, 2, 10 different accounts. You know, on 1v1me, you can make one account and then we hardware ban everything once you ban you. So we're more strict, but we're allowed to be more strict because we're 1, venture backed, and then 2, so we have like money in the bank that we can use and sort of play the long tail game with, which is awesome. And 2, we don't take fees. When you start to take fees from your users, you start to question, should we ban this person? They bring us $50,000 a month. Should we allow this person in? They just deposited $100. Those sort of same decisions that you sort of can make start to become much trickier because your business model is basically made so that your players are bringing you money. So I think that by focusing on the fact that, you know, you can do right by the community and community wins long term, you could start to make those same decisions and sort of play the long tail game.
And what's interesting about that is I was thinking what you were saying, and there's this kind of societal conventional wisdom that venture could introduce bad dynamics into a company. But in your case, actually, a lot of the perverse incentives, especially in the short term, are neutralized by venture. And there are versions where, like you said, if you ran this like a small business, you would actually have worse incentives in some degree. Not that those can't be overcome, but that kind of flipped what the initial expectation would be. Okay, so I've got a couple big ones as we're nearing the last half here. Here's what I'm immediately reacting to. Our society hasn't really figured out gambling, it feels like, especially online, just from a pure like discourse perspective. I feel like, I'm sure you've seen these too, there's been a couple like big Twitter threads. So this isn't just like, oh, the New York Times wrote an article about gambling, question mark. Like there's starting to be an organic conversation around like our society's relationship with gambling, especially online. Like what's just your reaction to that conversation as you're building up in these like open spaces?
I mean, I think it's pretty exciting that more people are getting involved. You know, like I grew up around betting, right? All of my friends did it. There was a period of time where like I would call my friend Joe in California and I'd be like, oh, I just bet on NFL. Like he didn't even have access to betting. So I think one is just access. You know, like a lot of people would use a local person that they would put a bet through or whatever. Now there's like FanDuel, DraftKings. It's legal in I think 30 states or something like that. So eventually I think like sports betting will be definitely 100% legal in every state. I think New York was one of the hardest states to convince to do sports betting for a ton of different reasons that we don't have to get into. But I think
I'd actually love to, because like the way you set it up, you're like, look, like I'm from around here, it made sense. Like what is that?
I think just like the aspect that New York State wanted a ton of money. Like I think it's like a 51% or so tax rate that they wanted, and they only have a distribution of a couple different licenses. And I think culturally there's a lot of like, you know, if you think about betting, it's kind of really like immoral in some ways, right? So you have people that lose their money. Maybe they don't do it responsibly. So I think that if you look at it from a more negative lens, which a lot of people do, there were a lot of investors we actually pitched about 1v1me that said that they couldn't invest because a lot of their LPs were actually very against gambling. So I think that people like fundamentally just morally think of it irresponsibly. But I think the inevitable situation is like Roger Goodell is a perfect example in the NFL. He's the commissioner of the NFL. He was very against betting, like didn't want it anywhere around his stadiums and whatever. Then the second DraftKings and FanDuel and Caesars and BetMGM started getting massive, what happened? All like NFL commercials have DraftKings commercials. That's the live odds or while you're watching the game. At the end of the day, it's just a money play, right? Like people want their cut of the pie. They know that this culture exists and everyone wants some form of the action. So I think it's good these discussions are happening. I think that, you know, there's a huge aspect to me that believes in moral responsibility with it. Like I don't want someone to lose a ton of money because of 1v1 me. So we put safeguards in place that we're thinking about on how we can like incentivize people to graduate and, you know, get better over time and not just lose to the sharks. So I think you have to go about it with a responsible angle. And again, by not taking fees, you start to think about those decisions a lot more sane. But I haven't really been in those Twitter discussions or threads too deep to know what other things are going on. But I imagine it's sort of the same conversations. But I think more importantly, access is better right now. And I think that's going to allow more people to get involved, more conversations to happen. I think there's a world that exists where you're watching a sports game and you're able to grab your television remote and place a bet, and that gets charged to your cable provider or whatever. So I think the way people bet is going to change. And different startups are trying to do that with like every play you can bet on and different things, which is cool. But I think for, you know, stock trading, sneakers, collectibles, sports betting is just a tangential space for that.
Yeah. And then second to last question before we get into just like the more of the OnDeck investment side. I was really interested in when you said not everyone deserves to be like gaming at the level you're describing, because it goes against kind of our expectations, right? Like gaming, like there's no gatekeeping, like everyone's playing, you're kind of doing whatever you want. And if you want, like, just what's your... Right, so in sports, right, like we get this, right? There's developmental leagues. There's like, yep. There's just very like, what is the, what do you think? Like you said, as this space gets bigger and bigger and bigger, that conversation against who can and who can't will get bigger and bigger and bigger. Especially given your point about having your, I liked your rubric around what does responsibility look like. You don't have to have the perfect vision, but like, how do you think the like? Cause I want to say credentialing, because that's lame. Like that's super lame. No one wants that. But what does like a reasonable in-between look like?
We are thinking about how we can create a vetting process around being a player on 1v1me. Like, what does your 1v1me reputation look like, and how does that give you status across gaming in that particular game or whatever? Like, there needs to be some sort of social tier structure where it's like, this is where I'm at reputation wise, and this is like my relative skill to the community. So I think something like that just doesn't exist in gaming. It used to exist, but I think the harsh reality of the situation is if you're popular on Twitch, you get all of the opportunities to enter in those tournaments, because at the end of the day, the brands want their return on investment. How do they get the return on investment for a $100,000 prize pool? They get eyes on their brand. The only people that get eyes on their brand is obviously the people that are most popular on Twitch. So I think at the end of the day, if you can grow a Twitch following, you'll get all of the opportunities. There are professional leagues, so there are professional teams, and those teams can play in the professional tournaments that the games fund and provide, and you have to pay a franchise tag in most games to have a team similar to sports leagues, and you're able to compete. But I think there's no like underground in between, like minor leagues, AAA, that sort of thing. So I think 1v1me plays in like that amateur ground, and then eventually, you know, we can vet those players and maybe we build a professional scene on top of that. But I think responsibility in terms of deserves to play video games for money, I think in a responsible way that doesn't allow you to lose a ton of money in the process. There needs to be progression to get better. 1v1me at the end of the day, we like to think of the business as a game, right? Like games have already solved the progression aspect. If I played a game today and didn't get better or lost my first match or whatever, probably wouldn't come back, right? But I think the aspect of it is like, oh, there's community, you know, there's voice chat, there's text chat, you play with your friends. So you're locked in on the social side and different communities like that. But then on the progression side, they give you badges, rewards, NFTs, collectibles, whatever you want to call it, right? But there's something to move up into, right? So I think for us, it's similar. I don't think that someone should sign up for 1v1me today and deposit $10 if they're not prepared to lose it and they're not prepared to play someone that might be better than them. You have to really believe in your own skill. But what I do believe is we can eventually get to a point where we can convince people to try it and get better and get matched with people that they can compete against, and it could feel really good. But that doesn't have to mean they have to lose a ton of money in the process. So I think that there definitely is development on the professional amateur side that needs to happen in esports that doesn't exist today. I don't just think because you have a million followers on Twitch or a million viewers, that means that you should get into every single event. I think there needs to be an aspect of a competitive platform that we're trying to build where the best players come to compete regardless of their status. Like, it should really just be about your skill. It shouldn't just be about entertainment value or whatever. And those opportunities need to open up to the general public. So we're trying to really bring those players in, vet them, get them viewers, build social status around them, whatever we need to do to get them to that stage. And then hopefully there's more opportunities for them, whether it's a $100,000 tournament on 1v1me one day where the best players compete, or, you know, some sort of professional aspect like that.
So for last two questions. So firstly, how did COVID change the gaming space in the sense that, think about it, right? Like, everyone's at home. I started playing games again, yep, straight up because of COVID, right? Like, my Xbox One had sat like gathering dust and I started playing again. I spent, yep, so much more money on video games in the past 2 years and I'm like 30. So like re-entered the industry in a way that I would not have like returned to, if not. So just talk about that, like with things basically like opening up again, knock on wood, and this is like less your company, more just the industry and your experience. Like, is this just like a chart that's going up and down? Like, are people like me going to like stop gaming again in a year or two? Like, how do you think about that?
I think that I think it was great, like, long story short, but I think that fundamentally you can look at it from a couple different aspects. So people were locked away and Twitch numbers skyrocketed. Like, if you look at creator numbers during COVID, there were a ton of viewers watching them. And now that's dipped maybe 10 or 15%, similar to some of the stocks in the stock market, right? So I think there was a lot of hype around gaming, and some of those creators are coming back to earth that might have been averaging 2,000 viewers are now averaging 800 viewers because not many people are watching Twitch as much. So I think there's that side of things. And then I think on the culture side of things, it kind of allowed more people to open up, you know, like Ninja and Drake were playing during COVID or whatever that whole thing in Fortnite happened. I refer back to Grayson Allen. He plays Apex, was doing a lot of that on COVID and starting to stream. Sean O'Malley's in the UFC. He started to stream. So I think it just allowed athletes and different rappers and celebrities to be more open about the fact that they game and kind of normalize it and make it cool. Like, I believe that everyone plays video games in their downtime. It doesn't matter how famous you are, how busy you are, whatever. I think at some point someone's played a video game in their life, whether it's an arcade or whatever, someone's played a video game. And I think a lot more people out there than you think actually play games every night. Can give you an example. When we started the business, Meek Mill was playing for $5,000 in Call of Duty against like him and his other friends. So that's someone that you would never think, oh, well, he's going to start playing Call of Duty for money. But no, there were Call of Duty lobbies that I was subject to, that I had word of, that I could participate in, where he was doing that with other rappers and celebrities out there. So I think that on the celebrity side of thing, I think it just made people more open to like, damn, Warzone is super cool. I want to like flex that. And then I think, you know, there were people that bought consoles that didn't have one before because there was nothing else to do. So I think that a lot of people had grown up just like me from 14 to 25, 26, whatever, that sort of stopped playing games around like 21. You know, when I moved to New York when I was 21, I stopped playing games for a period of like 2 or 3 years, you know, sporadically here and there. But, you know, a lot of the culture was around working really hard, going out after work, making friends in the city, you know? So I think that a lot of people during COVID went back to, oh, let me play games like I did when I was a kid. Let me get a console in my room. It's the only way to really talk to people because everyone's locked away unless you want to sit on like an awkward FaceTime or Zoom for hours. Video games are very high barrier. You know, you can just put on, or low barrier. You could put on a headset. You don't have to look fancy. It's not about like, you know, flexing in front of a camera. So I think that the social aspect really brought it all back. And I think people are just realizing that games are fun again and people are finding their passion, and it's something to do to really relieve stress.
Yeah. I'd love for you to close with just a, you know, quick articulation of your OnDeck experience, right? So you're starting a company during COVID, like Eric Torenberg, co-CEO, invested through Village Global when he was doing that full time. We'll just close there because I think it's a, I don't know, man, like, I just podcast through On Deck, but like, it's cool to know that like people like you are doing stuff like this, because
yep,
I think what being a founder is and the spaces you're building are just changing. And I think it's really exciting.
Yep. So when I first heard about On Deck, I was very, very skeptical. You know, I've never would have thought paying for a degree in startups. You know, I worked for two of the biggest startups in New York, Skillshare and Grailed. Like who could possibly tell me something that I haven't read or like heard from one of those founders that are like crazy successful, right? So I think that at first I was super skeptical. We started the vision for 1v1Me and I had pitched my friend Sidanshu. He was working at Sequoia at the time. And he basically said, look, dude, like you got to go back to the drawing board. Like you're not ready to get funding. You have no idea some of the basic questions I'm asking you, all this shit. And this is like one of my close friends, you know, so he's shooting to me straight. And he's like, but there is a buddy of mine who just did this On Deck fellowship that you should check out. So, you know, that's when I first heard about it. Again, I was skeptical. You know, you're paying for a tuition sort of thing at the time. It was the fellowship program. I think it was like $2,800 a month or whatever. And then basically, like, I decided to sign up because, again, I was making like $200,000 a year. You know, I was pretty fed up with my life at that point. My job was impacted from COVID. I was like, you know what? Why not? This thing has legs. It seems like there's some good people behind it. I didn't know who any of the people involved were at the time. You know, I didn't know who Turner Novak was. I didn't know who Eric was. When I joined the fellowship, I was like, oh, okay. So Village Global is affiliated with On Deck. That makes sense. I had no idea who they were. And I would say at the end of the day, like On Deck changed my life. Like it surprised me in so many different ways. Like I was able to raise $2 million because I did the fellowship. The doors were open for me by like different people in the community. I met some of my best friends because of On Deck that are other founders that I've, you know, helped raise money or they've helped me through like mental stress with becoming a founder. So I think for me, it's like, you know, the community is sort of the strongest aspect. Everyone feels like they have your back. It's not hyper competitive. People are super friendly. And then I would think fundamentally, it just like at the end of the day, like helped us really get started. You know, like On Deck was the first check in our business. Village Global was the second check in our business. They've been super helpful and super exciting to see how much they've grown. And then I think for us, it's like we were able to close $2 million by the end of the fellowship. That's insane for I think what was a 6 or 8 week fellowship. And you know, I think COVID helped out a bunch too. Like I think the fact that video games was super hot, I don't think that like, you know, just because you join On Deck means you're going to raise like $2 million, $3 million. You got to put your head down. You got to be involved in the community. You got to put back and give back. And you got to really work hard. There were periods of time where Vikram and On Deck was giving me feedback on our pitch deck before they even invested. And I would turn that around in like 4 or 10 hours the next morning. So I think like, you know, nothing gets handed to you. But I think that the opportunities are there. If you join and you seek them out, you can find success. And I think that for me, it was really a life-changing experience. And for Alex, my co-founder as well. So I think I would encourage everyone to join On Deck. This is not paid solicitation. Like I feel very thankful for the situation we're in, but I would say that it is a great first step for founders, especially new ones. And I think what they're doing with the whole Catalyst program or, you know, how they, you know, are starting to invest in companies in a more strategic way and actually bring them in and help them get to the next level, is super, super smart. And I think that's something I would have probably taken advantage of, if that was an offering when I was in the fellowship. So I think all opportunities are great. And yeah.
Man, really well said, Anthony. and I appreciate the, I am not paying Anthony, under the table to say that. Don't check my Venmo history. Yeah, dude, this is really great. Thanks for coming on the show. Best of luck. Cause I really, as long-term vision starts to shake out more, we'd love to have you back on just because I think like there's a lot of things that are being tested right now in your space, obviously. And I think in like the next 2-3 years, a lot of the hypotheticals here are going to be very much like in action. So I think that's really exciting to follow.
Yep, we're 6 months into this journey, if you actually think about it. So yeah. There's a lot of room to grow. We've grown a ton, but I think that it's going to be really exciting space in 2 or 3 years, especially when you start to think about like esports betting legislation. So that's where we'll really find ourselves, and I hope to be back.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for coming on the show, Anthony.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us in the deep end. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.